Yes, there was also some business and economic news this week, y'all. Rising interest rates, a massive Facebook hack, the future of Tesla. We've got you covered. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios at Colorado Public Radio in Denver, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, the 28th of September. We made it. Great to have you with us. I'm also glad to have Sudeep Reddy, managing editor at Politico, and Kate Davidson of the Wall Street Journal with us, because as we do every Friday, we're going to start with a recap of the week in economic news. Hi, you two.
Hi, Amy.
Hi, Amy.
So, Sudeep, let's start with the trade news going into this weekend. Hope seems to be dimming that Canada will join this deal between the U.S. and Mexico to renegotiate NAFTA. Where do those negotiations stand?
Yeah, hope always seems to be dimming when it comes to trade deals. This is obviously a volatile time when the Trump administration is trying to push hard to renegotiate what it sees as unfair trade deals around the world. And it's obviously taking a very tough line. The president was very blunt in his press conference this week after the UN, saying that he's going to maybe move on without Canada. But the reality of these things is that you get up to a deadline. Washington and other governments use deadlines to force conversations, delay a little bit past it, and then restart to figure out how you can revive a trade deal like this. It seems likely in the end that Canada, Mexico, and the United States will come together on something, but it's going to require a low point, maybe even a lower one, before that happens.
So a little more panic before a deal. So moving on to the Fed, earlier this week, officials voted to raise short-term interest rates another quarter of a percentage point. No surprise there. It's the third increase this year. But Kate, there was a bit of a surprise in the wording of the statement. Can you talk about this word accommodative and why it no longer applies?
Sure, yeah. So accommodative is a word that has been in the Fed's statement for a long time. It basically means that interest rates are low enough to keep stimulating growth and spurring economic growth. So now that rates are rising, eventually they're going to get to this level that officials call the neutral rate. It means that rates are neither spurring growth nor slowing the economy. And that's going to be an important moment, because some of Fed officials have been arguing that the Fed should stop raising rates when we get to that point. The problem is we don't really know where that is. It's very uncertain. That's something that Fed Chairman Jay Powell has been talking about. So yesterday, or Wednesday rather, he said, you know, we should just get rid of the word accommodative. This is what the committee decided, because, you know, if we wait too long and take the word out later, that might look like we're sending some signal about where we think rates are. That might signal, people might interpret that as, you know, the Fed is about to start to stop raising rates. And that's something that we want to avoid. And it's kind of goes with his general emphasis of, you know, removing forward, what they call forward guidance. That's signaling something about where policy is headed. He's trying to get away from that because so much of this is, you know, what's happening with the economy in recent years is uncertain.
Sudeep, what does it tell you about where we are in this economic cycle?
You know, when you look at everything that's happening in the world, the uncertainty in emerging markets, the wretched mess that has become Washington, even worse than before, it is pretty remarkable that the Federal Reserve is talking the way it's talking. We have relatively stable economic growth, relatively stable inflation. The Fed really just trying to manage the economy carefully so nothing bad happens while all this crazy stuff is happening around it. And so the way the Fed chairman was talking this week was really a measure of stability, a voice about how to maintain a normal world by normalizing interest rates, by normalizing business sentiment, keeping everything in a relatively calm period. That's the role of the Fed, and that's what he and his colleagues seem to be fulfilling right now.
But Kate, just real quickly, you know, the Fed is talking about three more years of growth, but it seems like more and more economists outside the Fed are talking about a looming recession. What are they seeing that the Fed is not, or not choosing to talk about anyway?
Well, I mean, we've certainly heard some people talking about, or, you know, pointing to the bond market, which is, you know, could signaling that the risk of recession is rising. So if you look at the Treasury bond yield curve that tracks the return that investors get based on the maturity of the security that they own. So the difference between short-term yields and long-dated Treasury yields, if you'll bear with me, this is a little complicated.
Yeah.
It's been getting closer. Yeah, it's been getting closer. And so if short-term yields rise above long-term, that's known as an inversion in the yield curve. And what that basically just means is that inversions have a long history of preceding economic downturns. So some people think we're getting closer to that point. So it's a very closely watched signal of a recession. So some economists think that the Fed, just by raising rates, could cause an inversion and possible recession. But Jerome Powell, others at the Fed have really downplayed that concern. They say there's nothing to make them think that the probability of a recession in the next year or two is rising.
All right. Kate Davidson of The Wall Street Journal, Sudeep Reddy with Politico. Thanks so much and have a great weekend.
Thanks, Amy.
Thanks, Amy. You too.
On Wall Street today, basically flat. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Two of the tech world's biggest names are making news at the end of this week, Tesla and Facebook. The leadership of Tesla is up in the air after the SEC announced yesterday it's suing CEO Elon Musk for making what it called false and misleading statements on Twitter about taking the company private. And Facebook revealed today that the data of tens of millions of its users had been exposed to hackers. Here to unpack these stories is Marketplace Tech's Molly Wood. Hi, Molly.
Hey, Amy.
So it seems so far the board is standing by Musk as CEO. But if all this gets to be a bit much, what is Tesla without Elon Musk?
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty remarkable that you're now seeing multiple research firms, all kinds of analysts. There's a headline on Forbes today saying essentially Musk must go, that there's no other credible outcome for Tesla. But at the same time, those analysts are saying, look, half of Tesla's value is tied to Elon Musk, and that if he goes, that stock price drops by half, and no one really knows what happens. But certainly a protracted battle with the SEC is not something that anybody wants to see happen.
You got to wonder how you even go about calculating that. But half is a lot. how much has Elon Musk actually accelerated the market for electric vehicles? I mean, has he already sort of had the impact he's going to have at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's partly the question. I spoke with some experts who say that, you know, Tesla or no Tesla, Europe in particular was going to be moving aggressively in the direction of electric cars, mainly because of the diesel emissions scandal. You know, they were going to go all diesel and then got caught cheating on these emission standards. And now you see a lot of European automakers moving aggressively toward electric. They also say that Tesla hasn't necessarily proven that there's a mainstream market for electric cars, partly because the Tesla Model 3 has not been produced in large numbers, as you may have heard, and that Tesla has really prioritized producing the really expensive Model 3s, not the $30,000 version. On top of that, at least in the U.S., the electric car tax credit has been a big reason why people have been buying electric cars, and that's in some jeopardy. It looks like Tesla and GM have now probably gotten close to selling enough cars where that those tax rebates will wind down. So we have to see if people really want electric cars, even if they don't get a $7,500 federal tax credit.
I wonder, though, about Elon Musk's own goals. I mean, is it possible he's done everything he wanted to do in electric cars and he's ready to focus on rockets, the Boring Company?
I mean, this is a guy with let's say, an agile mind, right? Yeah. He has a lot of interests. There are a lot of things that he wants to do. But I think that he is not going to leave Tesla without a fight. I don't think he's accomplished what he wants to accomplish. And I think he's really committed to taking that company over the finish line.
Well, before I let you go, we got to talk about the big tech news of the day. Another Facebook hack, this time 50 million accounts.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah, this is a bad timing situation for Facebook, to be sure, and also sounds like a pretty serious breach. I mean, unlike Cambridge Analytica, where it was often described as a breach, but in fact it was a sharing of data. This seems like hackers really did get into the system and compromise as many as 50 million accounts. You're already seeing a lot of questions from the Federal Trade Commission. One of the commissioners tweeted saying, I want answers, because, of course, the FTC has a consent decree, an agreement with Facebook from 2011 over how well that company protects data. Over in Europe, where they have that new big privacy law, the GDPR. They're wondering if Facebook has properly disclosed how big a deal this breach is. And honestly, it's only likely to just increase scrutiny on the company and maybe even calls for regulation here in the U.S.
All right, Molly Wood, host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Amy.
The next generation of student borrowers is about to be born. Starting Monday, students can file a free application for federal student aid for the 2019 school year. The FAFSA, as it's known, is the first step in getting federal loans and grants for college. Graduating students who take out loans are carrying an average debt of about $37,000. Not surprising, then, that some borrowers are hoping part of their debt will be forgiven if they become teachers or public defenders or social workers. Turns out that's pretty hard to do under a Department of Education program for public sector workers. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris explains.
To qualify for the Department of Education's loan forgiveness program, applicants must spend at least 10 years working in the public sector or for certain kinds of nonprofits and make the first 120 monthly payments on their federal loans. For Kristen Doyle, who is graduating with about $50,000 in debt, that was especially attractive.
So it definitely eliminated private sector employment entirely because I knew that, realistically, that was my best chance of not having the loans control my entire life.
So she went to work at a nonprofit and now works in county government in Los Angeles. She plans to apply for loan forgiveness in 5 years when she's eligible. This month, a report from the Government Accountability Office found that of the 28,000 applicants who applied for forgiveness since last October, not even 100 had their applications approved. The report says a poorly run program has led to a lot of confusion for borrowers. Jason Delisle is with the American Enterprise Institute.
The student loan program itself is complicated. So, you can see people ending up in situations where they're using one set of benefits, which precludes them from getting another set. And they didn't know that.
Delal says there is confusion about how eligibility requirements are met and what even constitutes a public sector job. Jared Bass with the think tank New America says when people don't get their debt waived like they expected, it's discouraging.
Why would people go into public service or be motivated to go into public service by this program if they don't actually get the forgiveness that they were promised?
The Department of Education declined to comment for the story. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
When it comes to consumer credit, borrowers are in better shape than in more than a decade, at least according to Fair Isaac Corporation, the folks behind the FICO credit score. The average FICO now stands at 704 compared to 686 during the financial crisis. The average Vantage score, a competitor, is at its highest since 2012. So what's going on? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look.
The biggest factor in your credit score? Your payment history.
Have you historically paid your bills as agreed?
That's Ethan Dornhelm, Vice President of Scores and Analytics at FICO. Dornhelm says 35% of your score is based on your payment history. Another 30%?
Is amounts owed. And here we're looking at how indebted the consumer is, how maxed out they are on their credit cards.
Dornhelm says consumers are in better financial shape now. Fewer are missing payments. So credit scores are on the rise. What do you get with a credit score of 704? Lower interest rates, for one thing, which can save you around $20 a month on a typical mortgage. The bigger savings comes from low credit card rates. Ted Rossman of CreditCards.com says rates for consumers with bad credit scores can reach 30%.
For every $1,000 you borrow, 30% of that is going to be $300 a year.
And here's the rub. Credit scores don't typically count things like whether you paid your rent on time. Carmina Lass is with the nonprofit Credit Builders Alliance.
In low-income communities, rent might be the biggest expense of the month. And so not having the opportunity to have that reported means that they might have no credit file at all.
And no credit score. Lass says that can make it harder to find a place to live or get a job because landlords and some employers use credit scores to evaluate people. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Now you're taking my car, now taking my job, and now giving me food stamps. It doesn't make sense.
When a parking ticket can put you out on the street. But first, let's do the numbers. On Wall Street, trade had ended up pretty much where it started. The Dow Jones Industrial Average edged up a fraction of 1%, 18 points, to end at 26,458. The S&P 500 was flat to close at 29.13. The NASDAQ gained a fraction of a percent, 4 points, to finish at 80.46. For the week, blue chips lost 1%. The S&P 500 shed 0.5%. The NASDAQ gained 0.75%. I guess investors don't like lawsuits from the SEC. Shares of Tesla crashed down nearly 14%, and they don't like data breaches either. Shares of Facebook thumbed down more than 2.5%. Bonds slid. The yield on the 10-year T-note inched up to 3.06%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody, it's Kai. You know, I do a podcast with Molly Wood. It's called Make Me Smart. We talk about the big issues in tech, the economy, and culture every week. This week, we get smart about stock buybacks, how they work, and what can happen in the long term if they don't.
Businesses need to be cognizant that if they're propping up a bubble and the bubble pops and we see a downturn in the business cycle, they're going to be the ones to suffer.
It's called Make Me Smart. Check it out. iTunes, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. The rate of home ownership in this country is about 64%, still lower than before the housing crisis last decade. And today, many are facing another housing crisis, one of affordability. High rents and low supply have put home prices out of reach for many Americans. My next guest argues that the federal government should do more to help lower and middle-income people buy their own homes. Connor Sen is a portfolio manager for New River Investments and writes for Bloomberg Opinion. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Why is homeownership such an important source of wealth for, as you say in your article, people who aren't rich?
Right. Well, so the wealthy, the top 10% of households have about 90% of all stock market wealth. And that's just because, you know, you could talk about its policy choices, how we tax capital less than we tax labor, or just they're the ones who can survive through recessions and not have to sell their stocks. And homes are something that everybody, at least not everybody, can aspire to afford, but it's a more aspirational thing in America. It always has been. And this, the data bears it out that that's where most middle-class families have their wealth.
What's happened to home ownership at the lower to moderate income end of the spectrum?
So over the past 10 or 15 years, so going back to the boom-bust period, that's really where the source of inequality this decade has come from. The wealthy, and especially white households, have seen their wealth from housing and home ownership more or less maintain where it was or even hit new highs, whereas the lower middle class and especially non-white families saw a big loss there. And so the homeownership rate at the national level has started to recover over the past year or two, but it's just barely starting to trickle up in for households like Black and Hispanic families, whereas white households didn't see the same loss.
A lot of people think that the financial crisis was caused, at least in part, by too much home ownership, that we were pushing it too hard, people were getting in over their heads. But you say that's actually a myth. Why is that?
Well, so the home ownership rate did hit its peak at the peak of the housing credit boom. But really, the thing where we got caught was too much leverage and too much debt. And so there were such thin cushions on both the home ownership side and the lending side that you had this systemic collapse that had to be rectified by the government.
You argue that the federal government should be doing a lot more to encourage home ownership. But of course, we have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We have FHA loans, VA loans. It seems like the government does a lot already. Why is that not enough?
I think you want to look at outcomes and see sort of where we are in terms of how people are doing in America on the housing side. We've seen a lot of recovery in wealth, again, among the wealthy and educated households. And for people who lost their homes or couldn't afford homes over the past 10 years, we've seen their rents go up, and they're really struggling to to make ends meet. And so I think if you start from outcomes and say, how can we improve outcomes, then government becomes kind of one of the first places you look. And so that's when you look at the programs we have and see, what are we missing? What could we do more of?
Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat, just proposed this week a bill that addresses the housing shortage and high rents. Obviously, in this Congress, it's not likely to go anywhere. But what did you think of the bill?
I thought it was encouraging to see that she put out something, especially since we've had this political cycle since 2010 dominated by Republicans, and they haven't shown a lot of interest in addressing housing. We would hope that Democrats would sort of take up housing as one of the things they want to focus on. And Elizabeth Warren, given her background in consumer credit and Wall Street, seems like an obvious champion to raise the issue, especially as she thinks about running for president in 2020. But whenever they do get power back, housing is going to be something that they have to address. And so why not get started now and see what sort of ideas the party can agree upon?
You know, big part of the barriers to homeownership for people now are the high prices. And a lot of that is because of limited supply. What do you think needs to happen to have more housing available?
So one of the big issues here is really local control over zoning and the fact that sort of wealthier, thriving neighborhoods tend to restrict the amount of construction that can be permitted in their communities. And so one of the issues that Elizabeth Warren's bill does address is sort of creating this pool of money that communities could apply for block grants for things like parks and schools, but they could only access that money if they were to loosen their zoning requirements. And so more middle-class suburban communities might sort of think that that's something worthwhile.
All right. Connor Sen is an opinion columnist for Bloomberg and portfolio manager for New River Investments. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
While home ownership remains out of reach for many people, so does just having an affordable place to live. The number of people in this country who were homeless on any given night rose last year for the first time in 7 years to more than 500,000 people. More people are relying on their cars for shelter. In Los Angeles County alone, the estimated number of vehicles as beds is more than 15,000. For people living in those cars, having it taken away could mean losing both their home and their work. From the California Dream Project, a nonprofit media collaboration, CalMatters' David Gorin reports.
It's chaotic here inside the lobby of the next-door homeless shelter in downtown San Francisco. And Sean Coyote, formerly of Lagos, Nigeria, says he really shouldn't have to be here.
The last job I had was delivering food for Uber Eats.
Coyote owns a car, a used red 2003 Mercedes-Benz he picked up for $1,000, and he used it to earn a living. Not that much of a living. He's been homeless for 6 years. For a while, he was sleeping in that car. But that came to an abrupt end one very early morning in March.
I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and there was a guy behind me. And I'm like, what are you doing behind my car? Oh, I'm just waiting for the tow truck to come and get you.
San Francisco traffic officials towed and impounded Coyote's car a few hours later because he had too many overdue parking tickets. Coyote says he watched his whole world roll away from him.
I am a homeless guy that walked my way out of homelessness. Bought my own car. Now you're taking my car, now taking my job, and now giving me food stamps. It doesn't make sense.
Coyote is not only looking at more than $6,000 in late fees and parking tickets, but the tow yard tacks on an extra $71 every single day to store it there. Now that he's 6 months out from losing his car, he'd have to pay more than $21,000 to get it back, which is about $20,000 more than he paid for it. So Coyote is suing to make the city give him back his car. According to Jude Pond, one of the lawyers helping Coyote, government officials shouldn't be allowed to tow away someone's home to pay a fistful of fines. He calls the state law that allows it unconstitutional.
We're hoping that this case sets the precedent that the city should not take people's only asset for the purpose of satisfying a debt.
If the restrictions were not enforced, then nobody would comply with them.
That's political expert Zev Yaroslavsky, who teaches at UCLA now, but also spent 4 decades as an elected official in Los Angeles. So he gets why cities want to hold on to that impound power.
As a local elected official, I was never concerned about the revenue stream that we were getting out of the parking. It was motivated by getting turnover in the limited parking spaces that we have available at curbside.
cities are allowed to tow a car away if it has five or more overdue parking tickets. A federal judge is expected to hear Coyote's request for a preliminary injunction to get his car back. Then Coyote hopes to start working again. Maybe get a break on some of that $21,000 he owes in towing and parking fines. In San Francisco, I'm David Gorn for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, Sears, once one of the great titans of retail, is now a penny stock. Shares closed today at 97 cents, an all-time low for the 126-year-old company. The department store chain's shares have fallen more than 85% over the past year as it's fought to avoid bankruptcy under crushing debt. Analysts say a big debt payment next month is the reason for today's drop. Interesting bit of trivia, though. Sears' all-time high of $195.18 was in April 2007. That's it for the week. We got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average edged up a fraction of 1%, 18 points. The S&P 500 was flat, losing a fraction of a point. The NASDAQ gained a fraction of a percent, 4 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fergali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. And a big thank you today to Brady McNellis, Joe Pestovich, and Peter Kramer here at CPR. I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. Have a good weekend. We'll see you Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.